It's Independence Day. I don't call it 4th of July. I call it Independence Day because, well, it is our Independence Day. And the tradition has been for me to go and reflect on what happened to our republic, where it's going. I remember I've done pieces on how to catch wild pigs, likening us, the Americans of old, to wild pigs who refused to be tamed. And then we got used to the government corn, and the rest is history.
But hey, today, John, yes. Do you remember that joke that we all used to tell in grade school? How many countries have the 4th of July?
No, I don't remember telling that story. That joke. I'm sorry.
They all have the 4th of July. It's just you.
Right, we're
right in saying only we have the Independence Day on the 4th of July.
There you go. Well, Charles Lipson, part of the tradition is reflecting what we're doing, where we're going, and thinking about what would our founding fathers think of us. And I'm looking up pictures to run for my, you know, my piece on the 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a beautiful photograph of President Biden lifting a champagne glass and toasting Xi Jinping. And I'm thinking, what would our founders think of Hunter and Joe and the 10, 15, $40 million, whatever they're talking about? And now we've got affirmative action, so which has been outlawed finally. You know, finally, they're pleasing many Greeks and Jews in the listening audience because we've faced quotas in the past. But that's why Charles Lipson is here with us today on the Chicago Way podcast with Jeff Carlin and me, and now Charles Lipson.
Well, John, my tradition is always to have a few Bud Lights.
Really?
Too soon?
Too soon.
I do that all the time. The too soon jokes. There's an affirmative action joke somewhere too that would be too soon. We can,
you know,
we'll get to that.
Do you know that was the phrase that led Gilbert Gottfried to do his amazing story about the aristocrats that became so famous?
No.
He was in the first comedy show. It was a roast of Hugh Hefner, and it was the first comedy show after 9/11. And he said, he told a joke. He was doing his regular, he was doing a routine, and he told the joke. And the joke was that he had tried to get a nonstop flight back from New York's JFK to LAX, but all of his flights stopped at the Empire State Building. And somebody in the audience yelled, "Too soon."
Yeah.
But my favorite is when anybody tells a joke about Abraham Lincoln's death and somebody yells that.
Right. The irony.
Right, because it's only 1865.
But the affirmative action stuff, the real issue is, in a way, the reverse of too soon, right? The real issue is
finally
that we got rid of all the legal impediments to discrimination. We made it discrimination illegal, is a better way of putting it, in the mid 1960s. We're now six decades past that. Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's worth going through just a little bit of history about what
all my lifetime. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what really happened was that a traditionally American pragmatic solution, people understood that it was not only slavery as bad as it was Since the 1890s, Jim Crow laws in the South, segregation in many places across the country. There were so many impediments to black success and black education that it really wasn't fair to say, okay, now everybody start your engines, let's race as if we were all in the same race together. So the initial solution that African Americans wanted, they weren't called African Americans by the for the most part back then, but what they wanted was quotas. Well, quotas were the kinds of things that had kept Greek Americans, Jewish Americans, Asian Americans, whatever, had put a ceiling on how many of them could get into top universities.
We have enough of you at Harvard.
Right. By the way, by the early 1900s, the children of the people who lived as peasants in Russia, the Jews who lived as peasants in Russia, made up about 24% of the entering Harvard class. That's why they put in a 10% quota. And they said it explicitly, and then all the other Ivy League schools adopted it. But the quotas for blacks were not a ceiling, they were a floor. You have to have at least 10% or 12% or whatever it was. Those were ruled illegal fairly quickly. And then affirmative action came in the early 1970s, and the courts approved it. But they approved it with two caveats. The first was explicit, and the second was implicit. The explicit caveat was it could only be a minor advantage. It couldn't be this huge advantage. But they never explained how you could determine what a minor advantage was versus a big one. And it turns out that the advantages were mammoth. If you look at things like medical school admissions and so forth, African Americans with a certain grade point average and medical SAT scores called MCAT got in with a 95% rate, and whites and Asian Americans and so forth got in at a 5% rate if they had the same, that same score. And in fact, to get to 95%, basically the majority populations, but also Asian Americans, basically had to be Phi Beta Kappa, you know, and score, you know, perfect on their MCATs to have the same admissions rates as African Americans. So there were huge advantages. But the second, which was implicit, former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said it out loud, but it was not, as far as I know, in a decision. She said, we don't expect this stuff to last forever. We expect it to fade away in 25 years.
About 25 years ago, she said that.
Yeah, it's about 25 years since it. And so that's the point we're now at. It was a pragmatic solution, a temporarily doing away with equality of equality in judging people because of the long history of setbacks. And what you what you hear as a defense for the people who still want it is that the effects still linger, that there's still a lot of segregation. They still can't be expected to compete on an even playing field, and all the usual kind of arguments like that. Those are the arguments that they say. None of this gets to a number of practical issues. We can talk about those, but I can tell you one thing that people will start to talk about next week. And that is a lot of corporations
Getting to the jobs.
Use these kinds of discriminatory criteria for hiring, pay, and promotion. And they will be subject to new kinds of lawsuits on the grounds that they are now discriminating in ways that are illegal. So I expect this is the beginning. It's also the beginning of universities doing what George Wallace once did, which was stand in the schoolhouse door. And how did he stand in the door? He stood in the door to stop blacks from registering at the University of Alabama.
Right.
But what universities are now doing is dropping all these standardized tests, not on the grounds that the standardized tests aren't a good measure of academic future performance, but on the grounds that they will leave a statistical proof that the university is discriminating in favor of some groups and against others in their admissions.
They're discriminating against Asians. They're discriminating against Chinese, Vietnamese, all the people that do well and study hard, children of people that have been denied, study hard on those tests and do well on standardized tests. And they must erase the evidence. That's why it's being done. It's to erase the evidence, like to erase the idea that Hunter Biden took five and then another five for his dad from the China. You know, it has to be done. They can't leave the fingerprints there.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And if you hear progressives, including some Asian American progressives, talk about this, they absolutely hate the term model minority.
Oh, yes.
And whereas they should welcome it, people are praising them for doing the things that we all were taught are the way that you rise up in America. There's nothing wrong with studying hard. There's nothing wrong with being with trying to form a family. There's nothing wrong with doing all the things that make for a model minority.
And maintaining your traditions, whatever these may be. This is done by people all over the world, but particularly in America, and particularly by Asian Americans who are carving a place for themselves against all odds, against the weight of the government, against the weight of the Democratic Party. Now, as this is being done, Charles and Jeff, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How will this play out? And my argument is that the more they complain about it, like they're doing on CNN minutes after the event happened, the Supreme Court ruled, they just cement themselves as racists and portray themselves as racists and get locked into that racist trope, even though they think they're doing God's work. What say you two?
What do you say, Jeff?
Well, I mean, that's the thing is, like, I was curious. I want to know if, and maybe I don't know the answer to this.
Don't
but,
answer a question with a question, my friend Jeff.
Oh no, but
I asked you.
It goes to the crux of why we were doing this in the first place, and the idea right. that mm-hmm. you know what their target is. Like, the idea that I understand that if I'm running a college and I have a population of kids coming in every year, and every year I have demographics of this population because I do that because we do that for some reason, and we see that there's like this, it's out of whack, right? There, we know what the national breakdown of, you know, races, which is such a BS thing in the begin with, but we know that idea, right? And so we throw it out there and we're trying to match that. We want to mimic what it's naturally occurring in the world. I understand that idea and that concept, and it makes sense. You know, if it's wrong, if it's off, then you should do something to recruit in minority areas more, or try to find, you know, programs to bring up minority groups. But they're doing this at the end of the race, right? Or the end of the event. So it's like saying that, well, you know, we're not going to pick the best car to drive. We're going to pick the car that no one else is picking. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
It's a hustler scream is what it is.
There's right. Let me offer a couple of comments on that. The first is that half the country votes Republican, and that's not the kind of diversity that they've gone out and searched for.
Sure.
Right? The second is that there are losers in this. Whenever you admit someone to an elite university, there are more applicants than you can admit. So you're saying that other people don't get in. And, of course, those people have legitimate complaints. But I think there's also an issue, and it was picked up in the book Mismatch, but it was originally thought of by Thomas Sowell, the great economist and social thinker. He said about the University of California system, where the voters outlawed this kind of affirmative action once, and then the administrators didn't like that, and they came back
voted again
a few years ago and tried again, and the voters voted against it again, including Hispanic voters. I think it was actually pretty close among Black voters. But what Sowell said was that there are 4-year universities in the University of California system of all different levels of elite admission. Some are much harder to get into, Berkeley and UCLA, than others in the system. And what he said was that if you eliminated affirmative action, you would get fewer affirmative action admits, African-American admissions, and maybe some Hispanics as well, at Berkeley and UCLA, but you would probably get more at some of the other University of California institutions. And that's exactly what happened. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I'm pretty good actually at math and science, even though I never majored in it. But if you put me at, let's say, MIT, I would pretty quickly move out of those fields, because anybody who's not Albert Einstein is not going to succeed in them. And for people who go in, and so you end up majoring in something that requires less rigor on the scientific skill side. So if you go into a university like that, hoping to come out as a microbiology major so you can go on to med school, you'll find that your whole career future has been destroyed. And that's exactly what's happened name of diversity.
And if I may, you're also shunted according, you know, we all know this. Yep. Many of these poor students are shunted into something else, like I could say urban studies, for example.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, we have John Cass is from the South Side, so maybe we could have a reverse application here, a white ethnic studying urban studies, and we convince him to waste his college career studying that ridiculous.
Whereas if you look at that first and second generation of the children of Jewish immigrants, the greatest historian of ancient Greece since Thucydides, Donald Kagan, was one of those.
Four volume history of the Peloponnesian War when he was president of the university that he served at the end of his career. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a great scholar, but you could also look at a lot of other fields, including mathematics and astrophysics and all these other fields.
Sure.
And that's not just a problem of being shunted. I think it's a very distressing and undiscussed element of our higher education system. If you look at fields like astrophysics, mathematics, molecular biology, things like that, that are extremely rigorous and so forth, you'll find that those fields don't look like the rest of America. And that's a real issue, but the answer to it is not to lower the standards in those fields. When you do that, you'll never you'll just water down the whole field and you'll let
other countries do better.
But it's interesting you mentioned that, because it's
going on now.
You look at what the breakdown you're talking about. Well, you know, the diversity probably isn't there as maybe by skin tone, if that's what we want to break it down. But if you look at the STEM push, which was, you know, kind of pushed, came through in the 90s, was this idea to bring women into sciences. Women in science fields has blossomed massively and beautifully, and you see it all right. Around lots of women in science now. And how did that work? It worked at the beginning. They brought them up, they nurtured this idea. This wasn't this, you know, knock them down and say, well, you know, you're really, this is really smart, but we gotta let this person in. That's not the way you do it. The other way is, and a person who actually, I mean, it's funny you're talking about like science degrees and like, you know, where that's changing. Someone like an Elon Musk, this guy has a bachelor's of arts in physics, and it's like you said, bachelor's of arts in a science degree. Like, how does that even happen? And then how does it even become useful to anybody? Well, he made it obviously useful, but that's that kind of weird altering of these science fields that we're seeing in certain areas. I mean, not all areas, obviously.
Well, this is an issue that's going to remain with us for. Not only because it's going to be more legislation, but because race is the deepest wound in American history. Mm-hmm. But the problem is not just that we live with its lingering effects. Some aspects have gotten much, much better. There's an African-American middle class, indeed an upper middle class. There's a lot more integration in our housing. There's no more redlining and things like that. But there is also, and this is not limited to African-Americans, this is true among poor whites and others, there's large numbers of out-of-wedlock births. There's a breakdown in the sense of community. In African-American communities, huge amounts of violence that ordinary people who live in those communities because of poverty can't escape from, and their children often have to join gangs and so forth. And those it's not that those are getting better. They've gotten worse over the last 20 or 30 years. And the answers that cities like San Francisco and other major cities, which is don't put people in jail just because they took $900 worth of stuff off of the counters of a Walgreens, is hardly the solution. People have a right to live in safety, and that includes people who live in those poor communities that need to go to a local Walgreens.
Well, that the social contrast, the contract collapses, another thing happens, and it hasn't been discussed in all the with all the race hustlers screaming about loss of their hustle in affirmative action, and that is, we had a program in Illinois, in Chicago, where kids from minority groups, from poor impoverished neighborhoods, got a chance to go on scholarship to some of the top preparatory schools. Yeah. And that's got the Illinois Opportunity Scholarship was killed because of the politics of CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, and the hard lefties, you know, and the Chase of Bodine types and all the rest of this nonsense. They won't mention Charles and Jeff. Yeah. The hustlers don't mention the fact that they have the reason why a lot of these kids are not succeeding is that people have been working against them relentlessly for their high school and grade school years. And then what do you expect them to do when they're graduating from high school?
Oh, I completely agree with that. But speaking about hustlers and so forth, I know you wanted to talk about Hunter Biden.
I wanted to talk about your fine article, which I see here, and I think it's you are selecting your own headlines as I can read this. Are the walls closing in on old Joe?
Well,
you don't have to choose between allegations against Biden and Trump, both sets could be true.
Yeah.
By Charles Lipson. And I, you have another good one come out.
Yeah. Well, I just find so many aspects of this Hunter Biden story so disturbing. And they would be disturbing if you read about this grift from anyone. But the important thing ultimately is how does it bear on the man who is now president and was vice president and was in the center of what looks to me like a family grift. And his defense now has boiled down to, I have a son who was in trouble, and of course I'm going to give him support.
I think all I love my son,
and I'm sure he does in a sincere way, but he also went on a TV show and said my son has done nothing wrong. This man is the head of the executive branch of the U.S. government, and the people in the Justice Department work for him, and they heard that. They saw that after he pled to a sort of tap on the wrist sentence, but he pled to a felony and two things that had been watered down to misdemeanors, that Joe Biden had his son to a big state dinner and took him up to Camp David. So they're seeing, and when I saw this, I was telling somebody in England today who wouldn't know Chicago politics that it reminded me of Mayor Richard J. Daley.
Kissing the mistletoe? Yeah. Well, you have to explain that to the...
Go ahead. You explain it, my friend.
No, he never said, if a man can't help his sons, he can kiss my mistletoe. He never said those words.
Exactly. But I love telling him, he said, if a man can't help his own son, what's the world coming to? You know, and then he added that the people who didn't agree with him could kiss something that they probably didn't want to, but that all politicians in the city did.
But Daley was shrewd for all the... He was very shrewd and understood human nature, which is why he was an excellent and successful politician for many years. And that's the problem. It's like Joe is wandering, you know, wearing diapers under the, you know, like lost in his own space. He doesn't know what's going on. He seems to not know. And that's costing him. That's going to cost him dearly.
Well, I think what's costing him is that the country is not doing so well economically. It should have recovered. Almost all the recovery happened because when you pull off the masks, finally, you get a quick recovery. And if you pump in a lot of money, you get a sugar high, but you also get inflation, and that's what's happened. But I think Joe's cognitive decline is becoming more and more evident. These are the gaffes that he makes are not just gaffes that he's made throughout his whole career. He's having trouble.
Long live the Queen.
He just a few hours ago when he was asked about this, he got up. He was talking to Democrat apology whisperer Nicole Wallace on an MSNBC, and he stood up and walked off like he's like, okay, bye. And he didn't know where he was going. He just marched high stepping away. This is the dangerous thing we're dealing with. Okay.
Yeah, I know. But
nuclear weapons. Yeah.
Nuclear weapons, and equally dangerous, the person who, if step down, the person who would step in is Kamala Harris, who is manifestly unfit.
That's the other thing. Now, what would I ask you as a professor, esteemed Peter Ritzma, chair of a great renown, author, lecturer, thinker? Thank you.
I'm thinking
selfishly, and I'm looking for a quote, okay, for my column, where I have all these. I found the one of the paintings of the creation of the Declaration of Independence. And I ask myself and I ask readers, what would they think of Joe Biden now? And that's what I ask you.
They would say he's too old for sure. And especially if it was relative to their time. I mean, and he's just not being up for the job. I mean, look at the first guy they picked. I mean, giant of a man, strong, even keeled. You know, everybody, like, nobody could say a bad word about him. And smart, and not necessarily, you know, Harvard educated, but like smart, nice guy. They would have, like, really? This is what we got? Who was the last guy you had? And then we go down the hill from there.
Well, you raise an interesting point, because I would say that the last three candidates for president in the major parties are Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton had a great resume and almost no accomplishments,
right,
and stood at the center. I think Bill was a gifted politician, but Hillary stood at the center of an industrial scale grifting operation. I think that I'm no fan of Trump, and I've written a lot about him. I think in Trump's case, although the indictments are serious about the documents, I think the stuff that Alvin Bragg brought in New York is just garbage. But the stuff about the documents, and especially the obstruction of justice when he said he'd return them but hadn't done it, that's serious. But that's not what's most serious. What's most serious is that he has failed to do the main thing that is required of the losing candidate in a constitutional democracy.
Yep.
Concede. And if you don't concede, you got to have very strong proof that the election was fraudulent. And I would say that Richard Nixon, when you can say that Richard Nixon sets a higher ethical standard for being a losing candidate than Donald Trump, you said something pretty damning.
Or Hillary, because I think... Yeah. I think that's the thing that infuriated those of us who supported Trump. I put myself in that category, is that Hillary and the Democratic Party would never concede. They played it like Stacey Abrams in Georgia. It was all this man is below us, and he's terrible, and he's a tool of the Russians. And they were saying all that stuff when they knew it was a lie.
That's right. That's a very important point. When George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq was a catastrophic policy error, but when people said he lied, when he said that they had weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. It's a misuse of the language. He actually thought they did, and there was a lot of reasons to think they did. They had had them previously. They wouldn't allow inspectors to look at them. There were all sorts of reasons to think I have every reason to think he was quite sincere in what he was saying. He wasn't lying. But I don't think Adam Schiff was sincere a minute. I don't think that Nancy Pelosi was sincere for a minute. I don't think all of those people I don't think that they were misled. They were misleading the public and lying about the information that they actually had. And I think and what those what the 51 intelligence officers did, which was in effect say, hey, we're not in the CIA or right now, but trust us, we really know inside stuff, and this has every evidence that it was a Russian disinformation operation.
You know who'd have loved that? Mustafa Kemal, because the Kemalists of the American government, those in the deep state, played that deliciously and well to destroy the argument that the Bidens had.
And then Biden, Biden, yeah. Remember, Biden went into a debate with Trump and went beyond what they said. He said it was absolutely false. It was Russian disinformation. Didn't just have the earmarks. And what people have missed in all of that is all he had to do was ask his son. I mean, it's not like he needed to get sort of a lot of information from other people.
So where are we now? Where are we with all this now? We have a presidential election coming. We have a fading president. We have somebody's lying, and I think our friend from the North Shore is going to be wearing the jacket, Merrick Garland, on this one eventually. And that's the first step towards impeaching Biden. But where are we now with all
this? I don't think they'll impeach Biden. I don't think they'll impeach Biden unless they have absolutely clear-cut evidence. We're just too close to an election.
Yeah.
And they also see Kamala Harris right behind him. But there's a reason. There's a reason. I mean, they'd like her to be the candidate, for sure, but not to be the president. But there's a reason, if I understand it correctly, why they might move to impeach Garland. Beyond the fact, there's a cost to impeaching him. Americans are concerned about the economy, crime, immigration, all those things. When it looks like the Republicans are in Congress playing gotcha politics, there's a cost to that. But the advantage to doing it is that the courts have ruled that the administration has to turn over basically everything Congress asks for in terms of documents and so forth. They can't stonewall it, and Congress can go to court and force that sort of thing in a way that basically the DOJ can turn them down on. Even if Congress has subpoena power right now, they can get turned down on all of that. So there are some technical reasons why they might move on all of this, but it certainly looks really bad. You just don't set up. You don't set up this many LLCs to move money around if you have a legitimate
the
business.
Whole family, even the grandkids, they were cut in on it. Yeah.
If a man can't help his own grandchildren. but there's also what the whistleblower who doesn't seem, I mean, if the whistleblower were a political figure, then the Washington Post and New York Times would have already exposed him. Right. I mean, they're out to get him if they can't. He looks, I watched the interviews with Bret Baier, and I've seen read the testimony and so forth. He looks apolitical, like he's just a very senior member of the Internal Revenue Service.
Yeah.
And on some of the things, like the statement that the U.S. Attorney for Delaware, David Weiss, said, there were six other people in the room, and Shapley made contemporaneous notes, sent them to other people who confirmed that what he heard was correct. Right. And now we've been told,
That is key.
It is absolutely crucial.
Contemporaneous notes sent to others. You can point that out to a jury in a criminal case.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that would be a good reason. I mean, if there's going to be a flashpoint that could push a premature, probably, impeachment of Biden, this would be it, because they're going to have the soups to nuts on exactly what happened.
Especially, no, they don't quite have, they don't have Biden in that picture. They have people working to protect Biden in that picture. They can link that to false statements made under oath by Merrick Garland. Now, maybe he was misinformed, but, but the fact is, by now, if he were misinformed, he should have investigated and come out in a press conference and said no. But it looks like it wasn't one event. it was just this whole series of things. They wanted to go and look at a sort of locker that Hunter had documents in. They were denied it. The guy wanted to bring cases, allegedly, according to the IRS, in various places. He was denied that authority. The IRS people themselves wanted to look when they saw that WhatsApp message, which was a Tony Soprano message to a Chinese businessman with high party.
I'm sitting right next to this man, and he's going to be very upset.
We don't know if that was true, that he was sitting next to him. We know, however, that the message was true, and we know, if the IRS people are to be believed, that they wanted to check where Joe Biden's phone was, which would tell them if he was in the room, and they were denied that. And they have said that this woman, Wolf, who is the number two to Weiss, told them at various stages that they were not going to do anything if it touched on the big guy. And we learned just recently that Tony Bobulinski, who was a partner and who met with Joe Biden and Hunter together, and therefore can say that Joe Biden's statements that he wasn't involved in any way, wasn't knowledgeable in any way, and so forth. He wanted to go before the grand jury in Delaware and was denied it.
It's unreal. I mean, and then compare that information with the, you know, the Ukrainian phone call and the impeachment that came from that, and how just weird it is that this is where we are. I mean,
where are Woodward and Bernstein in this? Where Woodward and Bernstein? Why CNN. Is the Washington Post doing nothing? Why is the New York Times doing nothing to investigate all
because
of this?
Because they don't want to challenge their own Pulitzers that they won for pushing the Russia collusion nonsense, which was a hoax. And they'd have to examine their own navel, really, publicly, in front of everyone, and they don't want to do that.
But John, that's exactly right. Let me pick up on one aspect of that, though. Remember when CNN had a town hall maybe a month ago, month and a half ago, with Trump?
Yeah, and it led to the
president of the network being fired.
Right.
When you have Tucker Carlson was let go he was taken off the air. He hasn't been officially fired by Fox News. What you got was a rising up in both cases of the people who were in those silos, those news silos, saying, we go to this silo for news that tells us exactly what we want, not for anything different. And so it's not just that the news organizations like the New York Times and Washington Post try to appeal to specific audiences. The audiences seem to punish them when they try to do anything different. So I see a kind of vicious cycle here.
I'm one of those who left the silo, left the Fox News silo, and I moved to St. Augustine to read again The City of God after Pat Hickey wrote a version of his essay for me at the John Cass News. And I have to say, not watching the screaming on cable, either from the left or the right, is rather soothing, gentlemen. I just have to
completely agree. I watch Hunter. I watch Brett Baer.
I
think he's excellent. I can skip past anything that involves a submersible submarine.
You don't want to buy gold, right? And the vegetables that you have to grind up in order to live a long life. Yeah. But listen, it's hot now, hot in July. But at the same time, the the days are getting shorter, and sooner or later, it'll be cold. It'll be cold outside in Chicago, and on the midway, there'll be someone walking, maybe perhaps trying to not destroy a cigar all the way, but enjoy a smoke as they're walking on the midway.
Yes.
And then go into a study and begin their history of this period.
Yeah.
What would you, Charles, what would you caution historians to think about, or what would you stress for them as they begin to?
Do you remember that movie that was called The Year of Living Dangerously? There was
The Sexiest Man Alive.
And then there was a book, and I can't quite recall the title, where was it Dominic Dunn's wife? I'm not remembering her name right now. She was in her own right a very famous author, and after her husband died unexpectedly, she wrote about what a crazy year it was. Ever since the COVID outbreak, we've lived in this very, very strange time, and we've been repeatedly lied to by the very people, not just by sort of political hacks, but by people who are lifetime experts in their field who decided to become political hacks. We were told that and then we live in a world of social media that seems intent on making our consciousness into 15-minute bites or 15-second bites.
Hysterically angry.
Right, seconds. And people are angry. And what I find is new about American politics, and I'm saying this sort of to you, Jeff, because I think you never lived in this time. But there was a time when you could vote Republican for Eisenhower and you could vote Democratic for Adlai Stevenson, and people on the other side, first of all, they didn't consider it something that you wanted to talk about at dinner.
Right.
Secondly, you lived right beside these other people.
Yeah.
And third, nobody viewed you as morally contemptuous, beneath contempt for doing that. But we now live in a much more ideological world. And certainly so among educated elites, the talking classes. John is a rare person in the talking classes who's on the right. But
the chattering classes, you mean.
The chattering classes.
Right, okay.
They're much more like Pauline Kael, the great movie critic for the Times for many years.
Perfect.
Said,
I know where you're going.
How did Nixon win? She'd never met anybody who voted for him.
Right.
By the way, when I lived for a year during the last year of Margaret Thatcher's rule, I lived for a year in London, and I literally never met anyone who voted for Thatcher in my social circle, which was an academic type, you know, an artist and things like that. So that may have been true among intellectuals for a long time. But now American politics looks more like British politics in the sense that it's ideological, where Labor faces off against the Tories. But the conservatives are now really have been overtaken by populists.
Yes.
And I think that on so many of these issues, people just look with contempt at people on the other side. And I don't just think it's the left looking with contempt at the right. I think people on the right who believe that abortion is sinful, and I could go on a long list, think that people on the other side of those issues are sort of moral cretins. And the whole idea of a tolerant democracy requires forbearance. It requires people to laugh at Adlai Stevenson's joke, yeah, which was meant as a joke. You worship God in your way. I worship God in his way. If you laugh at that, as John just did, I didn't tell it so well, but if you laugh at it, you know it was meant ironically.
Right.
As soon as you don't mean it ironically, people begin burning books, and soon after books, they begin burning people.
That is, I'm gonna leave it there, Charles, yeah, because I can't think of a better cap.
Not at all.
To this, and I doff my cap to you, sir.
Indeed.
Because we haven't even spoken about the other article that you're coming up with that our good friend Tom Bevan is about to publish any minute now. Can you tell us something about it?
Well, the Supreme Court's rulings at the end of the term on affirmative action, which we did talk about, and they have rulings on religious liberty and so forth. These are very important rulings. And I would say that on the other side, people should take a look at the fact that people who are unhappy with those rulings don't just say, well, we lost the case, we should move on and respect that. They say we should pack the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is illegitimate. One of the justices took a trip 12 years ago, a fishing trip, and he should be put in the pillories.
But let's leave Sotomayor alone, right?
But right? I mean, it's more than the hypocrisy. It's which just shines and stinks. It's also the sense that trust in our institutions has just dropped like a stone. And people would say, well, maybe that's well justified. The institutions don't deserve a lot of trust. Who trusts the CDC now to tell us where that virus came from? And remember, the CDC said, if you get a vaccination, you can't get COVID and you can't spread it to anybody else. Well, all of that was wrong. You can make initial wrong statements, but 6 months later, you got to tell us the truth, man. And Fauci,
Saint Fauci seemed
to come out with statements that were designed to cover the fact that they had put money into a research institute in China that was doing the work that may well have led to the spread of this virus. Why did they do that? Because there were laws in the United States that said you couldn't do gain-of-function research in the United States. So they tried to get around it by by outsourcing it to the Chinese. What could possibly go wrong?
So a few of them ended up getting tossed off the roof for some reason.
Yes, exactly. I think what I was saying is that the Supreme Court has been making rulings that seem perfectly consonant with the U.S. Constitution and some of the bedrock values that are encoded in it, which is freedom of religion. You should be required, if you're open to the public, to sell a cake to anyone, but you shouldn't be required to decorate that cake with a message if you find that message personally abhorrent and against your religion. Those kinds of things, if you believe in the Sabbath and you don't want to work on Sunday, and you were hired when nobody had to work on Sunday, so it was not part of the job requirement, and they changed the job requirement, the Supreme Court has now ruled that it infringes on your religious liberty rights to force you to do that.
Right. No dissent on that one, by the way.
Right. That's a very interesting point. And I think what you're seeing is some pushback there. But I do not leave with a sense that our republic is in good hands or in strong shape. I think the people in leadership positions in both Congress and the White House are not people that we can have a lot of. We cannot have high regard for. This is not Washington or Jefferson or Lincoln, or it's much closer to Warren G. Harding.
I don't think I used to think that Washington would take his cane out and have a few of them cane us, to, you know, as we scream for mercy. But now I think President Washington would really just look at us coldly and turn his back, turn his face away.
And the people in so many cities are busy just taking his name off of schools.
Oh, my God. Well,
on that happy note.
On that happy note. Happy
You know what? We have to do this again soon.
Each and everyone.
Because we have to talk about movies and, you know, stuff that we want to talk about, like what's a gun soul, for God's sake, and Maltese Falcon and...
Oh, I love
I am a man.
By the way, Gonzo was a made-up word.
Yeah.
Was a made-up
word. I don't know if it was made up.
It had a different meaning, I believe, in Yiddish or something.
Huh? Did the Gunsel drink Bud Light?
You have a future in advertising, my friend.
There you go. For Charles, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Charles.
What a pleasure. It's always great to talk with you, too.
And I want everybody to think as you're going to your food fest on the 4th of July that you call it, we call it Independence Day among the civilized people, Independence Day. I want you to think, what would it be like to have Charles Lipson as your professor? You'd be a very lucky person.
Well, thank you. That's a very generous, statement.
Not really, Charles. It's just a fact. Mm-hmm. No brag, just fact, like Walter Brennan used to say. For Charles Lipson, the Peter B. Ritzma Chair at the University of Chicago, longtime professor, writer, thinker, and you can read him in Real Clear Politics. You can read him in, what's the latest? What was
the American Spectator?
American Spectator. With a brilliant piece on the Biden family in the Biden Inc. And for Jeff Carlin, our friend, WGN executive producer, friend of cats, friend of pies, not friend of pies, they can't really form relationships, only one-way relationships. And for me, John Cass, who's now, I'm trying to write again, so I hope you subscribe to John Cass News. Thanks for joining us on this Independence Day to love our country as long as we can. But I want you all to, as we go, I want you to think of the father in Red Dawn, the first one, written by John Milius. Harry Dean Stanton was the actor, and he screamed to his sons as the totalitarian government descended upon them. Boys, avenge me! Avenge me! See you again on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Dad, I love you.
I know you do, son. I love you too.
Boys! Avenge me! Avenge me!
Chumbalone.